panellist Ed Armon talked about how he first heard Kate Bush. Here's Ed.
I was quite excited by your passion towards Kate Bush. So I listened to one song. I listened to one song. That was And Dream of Sheep. That was the one. I like her, and I'm going to make a commitment. I'm going to listen more. But I think I have one criticism. She needs to enunciate a little bit. She needs to, because I was thinking she's saying, and dream of cheese.
Now, that's his verdict of Dream of Sheep. And we got a lot of feedback, good and bad, about Ed Armon's review on the basis of one song, an entire career. But what about the song Kate Bush was most famous for, the one we played? So Ed Armon is back with us, and I believe he has listened to Wuthering Heights overnight. Ed, kia ora, welcome. What did you think of the song? Ed? No, we haven't got him. We'll try and get him back very shortly. But a lot of response regarding retirement villages. My father is in a village and loves it. Management fee fixed for life and includes rates, window cleaning, insurance, etc. So it is affordable. His estate will take a big loss on his passing, but I would rather he has a good time and is safe while he's alive. Mm. So that's
a good comment.
It's a good comment, yeah. And another one here. My mother bought into a retirement village operated by a trust, took legal advice. For the first 2 years, it was wonderful. Then they sold half to a company which changed all costing conditions. Huge jump in yearly fees. Residents were forced into signing new contracts, had no power to challenge this. It was awful. Lawyers are in for the rort. Review is long overdue. Now, Ed Armon is back with us. Ed, welcome.
Hello, Wallace. How are you?
Good. Did you listen to Wuthering Heights?
Oh, yes, I did listen, and I have been listening to it quite a lot. It's such a fantastic song. It's clear, it's me, Kathy. I've come home. I'm so cold. Let me in your window. It's great. And I take some of my criticism back, but I'd have to put some more criticism in. I'm sorry, Kate Bush. I have to. It was a little bit high. To my liking, because it's kind of talking about Kathy, who was a ghost in the book.
Yeah.
And if my lost loved one had come back with that voice, I would run away.
So that's your advice again to Kate Bush. If you're going to redo the song, do it in lower register.
A bit of a lower register. Enunciation has gotten a lot better. I guess she started with a good enunciation, and through the career, it went down a little bit. But I love her. All my criticism is coming from love. One interesting thing I would like to share with the listeners is that Kate Bush's birthday and Emily Bronte, who wrote Wuthering Heights, they have the same birth date, July the 30th. So that's been something interesting out there for everyone.
Ed, thank you very, very much. Ed Armon there, who is a new panellist and listened to Wuthering Heights. Swing and Listen, were you ever, or are you a Kate Bush fan?
Look, when you played that song, so many memories. You know,
really?
How, I don't know, if our family is unusual, but we have a song that at the end of the night, when the girls are all a bit under the weather, we've had a bit of wine, we dance to that song. We do expressive dance. Last time we did it all together was at my daughter's wedding last year. This is our song.
Yeah.
And we all get up and we do that creative dancing that you only used to do in the 70s, you know, lots of sort of making cloud shapes with your arms and sort of waving across the room. It's just the most beautiful song for expressing your love
for
each
other. Yeah, it's wonderful. I'm a big fan too. This is just news out this afternoon. MediaWorks has conceded a controversial exchange in which host John Banks and a caller condemned Stone Age Māori culture, broadcast on Magic Talk in January, was a serious breach of broadcasting standards, and the company says it will now educate staff on cultural understanding standing and broadcasting standards. And Media Works has told complainants an exchange between John Banks and a caller breached broadcasting standards, and it represented an organisational and editorial failure. I just wanted to bring this up because I know, Wendell, you're a well-regarded and seasoned broadcaster. I do believe, correct me if I'm wrong, spent a bit of time at the station or the one before. What do you think of this?
Yeah, look, when I first heard that, having a bit of experience with talkback, my immediate thought was, oh, sorry about my phone, my immediate thought was producer. Where was the producer? Because the thing about talkback is, as a host, you're supposed to create dramas. You know, you're supposed to get the audience all racked up, and you know, when you've got someone in there who's not doing it day to day, when you've got a host who's come in as a fill-in, as John Banks was, you have to have a producer there. Some of the worst things Holmes ever said on his show, his producer, Phil Armstrong, amazing guy, was not on that day. So, you know, their job is to go, oh, I think I'll just take that off here and go to a break, you know? And so I was very, very, very much sorry for the station and for the producer, whoever it was, who was, I don't know, getting a cup of coffee or not listening to the show closely. So for me, it was a failure of production rather than a failure of the station. And it can happen so quickly. You must know yourself. I mean, I'm sure you don't get many callers like that on RNZ. But if you did one, you'd have a producer who would dump them straight away. Peter? So that is my feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that even for Phil, and that you would, you know, have John Banks on your list. Yeah, I mean, it's organisational failure, but as Wendell said, you know, she has a bit of background to this, but why would someone bring in John Banks anyway?
So. 20 to 5, RNZ National. People are loving Ed Armand's reviews. All this talk of Kate Bush this week, my favourite musician of all time, discovered when I was 17 in the 90s, and I'm still an ardent fan. Well, taxpayers are footing a large annual bill for patients who need public hospital care after private inpatient treatment, according to a new study from University of Otago. Private health patients are costing New Zealand's public health system up to $11.5 million a year. The study is published in the International Journal Health Policy. So to explain just how, lead author Dr. Erin Penno is from the Department of Preventive and Social Medicine and Centre for Health Systems at Otago University. Dr. Penno, kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure. So explain this a little more for us. How are private patients costing the public health system?
So I think, you know, we tend to think that New Zealand, you know, as New Zealand, is being mainly publicly funded and provided health system. But, you know, most of us know that you can access private care if you have health insurance or if you could pay for it out of pocket. So I think we tend to think of those systems as being quite separate. But in reality, there's actually quite a lot of crossover between that. So we knew anecdotally that basically when patients had very complex clinical needs or their condition was deteriorating, that they were being transferred through into the private sector. But what we wanted to understand was how often that was happening and how much it was costing the health system. So that's how we arrived at that $11.5 million figure.
Right. So this might suggest that if you go private, as they say, and, hey, something happens, maybe an infection or you need readmission, follow-up care can't always be handled privately.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. So the private sector, some facilities, I think, have some ability to provide that sort of after-hours care, but by and large, they tend to lack that sort of acute care that you see in the public system. So they don't have typically intensive care units, or they don't run sort of 24/7 models. So if you need acute care, if something goes wrong after you've been discharged, you're going to need to visit your local emergency department, and the public system's going to pick up the bill for that. So I think that's what we sort of saw in the data coming through, that the majority of patients who are being readmitted into the public system were there for complications of care, so things like bleeds or infections.
Right. So, I mean, one might expect the cost of private hospital care to be borne privately. Would that be a reasonable expectation?
Yeah. You know, I think it probably is a reasonable expectation. And I think that's probably what most people would sort of think was happening. I think in the vast majority of cases that we were looking at, you know, only 2% of private patients had a readmission, so it seems like that's mostly happening, but there is that small proportion of patients who are moving through into the public system. And, you know, they are costing quite a bit. So I think, you know, our research really illustrates that there are some really blurry boundaries between the public and private systems. And I think when you reflect on that in terms of one of the things that has been working for our system is increasing the amount of private provision. But to really understand the impact of that, we need to understand what happens there. Is there an impact on the public system? And what would that be?
Okay, it'd be very interesting to hear our listeners if they, so for example, had a hip replacement that needed sort of a follow-up, whether you stayed in private or you went into public or what have you, because that's, I mean, hip replacement is one example, isn't it, that was brought up.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, when we looked at the reasons that people were moving through, it really reflected that elective nature of care in the private system. So it was largely things like hip and knee replacements and tonsillectomies.
Very interesting research, Dr. Erin Pano from Otago University. Thank you very much for your time.
Wendell.
Fantastic. Thanks, Wallace.
So here's the thing. Surely the number of people who are paying for health insurance and getting private health care are saving us money to start with, right? So we're not paying for all those hip operations and those knee operations because they're paying for them themselves, or their insurance is paying for it. So really we're only just mopping up when things go bad, which is basically what our hospitals are for, treating hemorrhages and infections and stuff that goes wrong. So I'm looking at it as, well, thank you. Those are all the operations we don't have to pay for in the public system. I wanted to ask Erin what she thought about that. But that's how I'm seeing it. And also having had a knee operation in the public system about 18 months ago, I do know that when you go public, they give you so much follow-up. You basically have to go to physio. You have to front up to the hospital. You have to be put through these really painful exercises. You go private, there's no follow-up. You basically don't go to physio. You don't have anyone checking on you. You don't have all of that. So it's interesting that in public, they're really taking care that you don't get those infections or those hemorrhages. They're making sure you do the exercises, where in private, you're just like, okay, see ya. So it's an interesting.
You've got to be out a bit quicker, do you?
Yeah, well, there's no follow-up. I mean, you get a checkup, but you're not encouraged. One of the most important things with hip and knees is that you exercise and stand up and move, get it going. Yeah.
In fact, it's fundamental, isn't it, with a hip operation and knee, the follow-up care, isn't it? What do you make of this issue?
I mean, it's a small sort of narrow scope in terms of the study. It's thrown up a quantum, and to be honest with you, the quantum is negligible in the scheme of the health sector, as the Heather Simpson, Brian Roach review showed us last year. It reaffirms inefficiencies within the health sector, and it reaffirms that, you know, the faster that the government can get those recommendations underway. You know, DHBs are dealing with this issue. And the other issue is, you know, that there was another study a few months ago around, foreign citizens coming into our country, particularly in counties Manukau, and utilising the health system and are unable to pay for it. So they're little small studies which show the efficiency of the operating model. So that's the bigger issue, which is a government issue. But the quantum itself, I mean, 11 and a half.
Small bucks.
I mean, 11.5 million. I mean, Phil Twyford used that, you know, to try and, you know, get us a train station out to the airport just on procurement. But you know, and that didn't work well. We still haven't got a train, right? So it's negligible within the context of the whole overall operating system that we have to deal with, and which the government and the DHBs, whether it be still 21 or 12, whatever the recommendation is, have to deal with.
It's 13 to 5, the panel. Yes, retirement villages can be a great environment, but the model is unfair where the village gets 25% of the initial capital outlay plus all capital gain. And my parents moved towns, so I had to face the same capital loss twice. Now, fellow panellist Chris Wikaitis says, oh, come on, Wendell. The PD rolled the dice on banks who had prior form. He rolled a pair of ones. The buck stops there.
Nice to hear from Chris again.
Now, you're on the panel, RNZ National, to this. The National Housing Spokesperson and Wellington-based MP Nicola Willis says the newly heritage-listed Gordon Wilson flats have become a symbol of the problems the city faces, saying on Facebook, the Gordon Wilson flats have become a symbol of the problems in our city, such as seismic risk, unoccupied, vandalised, helping no one, and yet forever trapped in time due to the whims of a few. It was announced this week that the 1950s flats that built, which were seen as a shining example of European modernism for some, or a brutalist Soviet-style eyesore to others, have been given Category 1 heritage status. And with us is Dr. Ben Schrader, a Wellington urban historian. Dr. Schrader, welcome.
Kia ora, Wallace. Kia ora, panel.
Kia ora, and I know we've discussed this before, Ben, on the panel, but it continues to fascinate, even as an architecture fan like myself. Why were these buildings given Heritage 1?
Well, I think that, I mean, there was a number of reasons, and I think the focus up to now has sort of been on the architecture, and in some ways I think it's a fruitless debate because... I mean, I don't think we'll ever agree whether the architecture is distinguished or just plain ugly, and I fully accept that for most Wellingtonians, it's the latter, the latter thing that they quickly come to. But the thing about the Gordon Wilson flats is, you know, in terms of heritage, it's not just the architecture which is assessed. It's also things like the cultural and social fabric of a particular place. So in terms of the Gordon Wilson flats, it was really important because in the 1950s, there was a huge concern in terms of city building and building of cities in New Zealand about urban sprawl and a real issue about, you know, we're using up productive farmland and, you know, if we used up too much, then we'd run into economic trouble because, you know, we wouldn't be able to export or grow our own food. And so there's a realisation that, you know, we need to build more intensely. And so the Gordon Wilson flats and its sister building in Auckland, which is the Upper Grays Avenue flats, which has been demolished, was seen as sort of a beacon of how cities could grow sustainability. So it was really as much the social and cultural heritage values of the building which gave it its Category 1 listing.
I see. Okay, so this is quite a big deal, actually, Category 1 for Gordon Wilson flats. Wendell Nissen, I don't know if you've seen a picture of it or you know the flats themselves. What do you think?
Look, I'm going to come down on the side of heritage. I think we've lost too many buildings in this country. And just because it's heritage doesn't mean it has to be beautiful. It has to represent a time in our society when we did things. And that really, as was just explained, that exactly explains why they were built. It was part of a sociological experiment. It was something that we did. We need to remember that. Why
99%,
we just
99% of people would disagree with you. To quote one Facebook post, they are ugly and a nuisance. There is nothing heritage about them. You look to Mount Vic for heritage.
Well, no, I don't agree.
Sorry. I mean, I'll just come in there because I mean, I think that is the problem. And I mean, I went past them earlier this afternoon and I looked up at them and I said, well, you know, I can see that they're an eyesore. You know, for the last 10 years they've been neglected. You know, there's graffiti on them. It's all fenced off. You know, and looking at it as a sort of, you know, just looking at it from the street and you think, oh, this is terrible, you know, and of course the first response often for those looking at those sorts of things, well, they should be demolished and we should put something up brand new. But, you know, one of the things I said before about, you know, it was seen as a symbol of sustainability of building new cities, and I really think it can be again because, you know, we've got a housing crisis in Wellington, and if it was adaptively reused and rebuilt, it could be sort of a beacon for sustainability again of using our old buildings, you know, rather than demolishing and taking off to a landfill, we can... you know, with a bit of love and care, bring them back to their original use. So that's something I hope will happen.
So Wendell falls on the side of heritage, Peter, on these particular facts. You've seen the picture. What do you think?
I fall on the side of Gordon Wilson. I mean, if he was here, what would he think? With the acute housing challenges that we have in Wellington and across the country, I mean, Ben, you've mentioned it. It's, you know, what would Gordon Wilson think, you know, at the time when he was... when he was, you know, designing these and it was for people, right? It wasn't for, it was for housing people. It was, you know, as you say, it was an experiment, but it was for people and the opportunity, therefore, to sort of recalibrate it in order to house people. I don't know. What would Gordon Wilson say, I guess, Ben?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he'd be supportive. I mean, the whole point of the Gordon Wilson flats was to house people that had been living in slums and damp, you know, mouldy houses. Mm. And here was a brand new building which was full of light, that was warm, and people that moved in there, you know, up until the time that they were closed, people loved living there. And, you know, because it was close to city amenities, it had wonderful sun and views across the city. And I was saying before, it could do again.
Mm.
So I think Gordon Wilson would be a supporter, and he'd be a supporter of building more such buildings, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Thank you. Ben, again, thank you very much for your time. Do appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Ben Trader there. And I do recall I went to a sort of panel discussion, actually, when they were talking about heritage in Auckland, and the person who helped save the Civic reminded us that actually back when the Civic wasn't so flash-looking, it too was seen as an eyesore.
Yes, it was. And you know, we when we could travel overseas, you know, we go and visit all these amazing old buildings, and they all talk to us about what, you know, even down to the Roman times, you know, what they were there for, why they were there. It was a place in history. And these buildings are a place in our history. And I'm looking at them right now. I think, you know, you could give them a real good spruce up. And, you know, as Ben said, they get a lot of sunshine, nice views, nothing wrong with them. Just fix them up.
All right, okay. It's 6 to 5, the panel, RNZ National.
Don't ask the Wellington City Council to do anything big when they've got their own challenges.
Oh, yes, there are some other issues that we, or the Wellington City Council. Now, for the first time ever, the Japanese government has appointed a Minister of Loneliness in an effort to combat a rise in the country's suicide rates. Japan reported nearly 888 female suicides alone in October, a 70% surge compared to October 19, according to the BBC. And in Queensland, a parliamentary inquiry now aims to address loneliness after COVID-19 lockdowns left many feeling isolated, reports The Age. But it was back in 2018 that an Australian MP, Fiona Patten, in the Victorian Parliament proposed that her state should get its own Minister for Loneliness. So I'm with Dr. Spencer Sawler from Loneliness NZ to talk about how being lonely affects people. Dr. Schooler from Loneliness NZ, welcome to the panel.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start with this idea of a Minister of Loneliness. It's getting a bit of traction in other countries around the world. What do you think of the idea here?
It's something we have written to the government about encouraging.
Right.
The reason for it is there is no particular place in government that loneliness naturally sits. It kind of floats across many departments, from health to treasury for wellbeing, through to Ministry of Social Development and many others. So by having a Minister for Loneliness, it provides a focus point for work to be undertaken to address what's a major problem.
And it's interesting, it's across the board, isn't it? Because I think you did a survey last year. Youth loneliness levels are far higher than those of seniors, which were 3.9% after lockdown.
Yeah, that's correct. If you put every 15 people in New Zealand who has prolonged loneliness, only two of them are actually senior 65 plus. The largest age group by far is those in the kind of 15 to 24 age group, and then it kind of descends down the ages and then becomes more of a socialisation hearing loss issue post about age 65.
Right. It's a bit of an indictment, Peter, and if we can circle back to your I've been thinking, you're talking about your young boys growing up, they're starting to be teenagers, and you hear youth are really predisposed to loneliness. What do you make of the issue?
Yeah, it's a big issue. I mean, in terms of, I get the argument of having a minister provides focus, but also within the government system, within our democracy, it also provides silos, right? And so given the issue does cut across various portfolios of ministers, you want to take a matrix approach to it, right? Because it affects every New Zealand citizen. So having a minister, yeah, I would love to see the argument for the value add, but to the other side of the coin is it creates silos, and we've seen that with other recent portfolios as well. I mean, a good one that I know is a portfolio of Pacific Peoples. I mean, it's taken 10 years to take a matrix approach on Pacific issues in this country rather than having it all through one lens of one small ministry. So, yeah, I see both arguments of the structure, but the issue itself. I mean, we're talking before about bringing up, you know, my children, and I'm seeing aspects of that distance and that loneliness, even when they're young.
It's been so while you're here. I mean, how can you help someone battle loneliness? What can others do if someone says they're lonely and unhappy?
Well, there's a number of issues. But first, they can be socially isolated, in which case a connection can help. The key inoculation, if you like, for loneliness is having meaningful connections. So if someone has five or more meaningful connections, then they usually will be less likely to be lonely. So it's about not having a large quantity of friends. It's about having high-quality, meaningful relationships, and that's the key to addressing loneliness for individuals.
All right, Spencer, thank you for your time there. Spencer Schooler there from Loneliness NZ. Can you relate to that, Wendell? Has there been any time in your life where you felt a little isolated or a little lonely?
Not really, but I know many people who have, and I think it is about connection. And I'm one of those really annoying friends that if I haven't heard from someone for a while, I'll be like, "You okay? What's up?"
Yeah.
You know. And I think we need to do that a little bit more, even if it is annoying. Just the odd text, checking in. You really have to check in on it.
Finally, regarding Gordon Wilson Flats, I've never heard so much claptrap from your panelists, but you've been great. Wendell Nissen, Peter Fiu, thank you very much for your time. Happy Friday.
Thank you.
I'm Wallace Chapman. Back Monday.